Hi, today is July 28th, 2019. This is Mobile Views Podcast 298. I'm Todd Ogasawart, my good friend John Westfall. And this is becoming kind of a trend for us. We don't have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
And yet we talk.
we do end up talking most of the time anyway. But yeah, I really did not have too much. I was traveling this weekend, this week actually, at a conference.
Oh.
And I used my phone a lot.
Yeah.
But there was only really one thing I found this week, and it was before I even left, that I thought was really interesting to talk about.
Okay.
And you've got your stuff, so where do you want to start today?
Let's start with you.
Okay, so this is a very, very quick tip, but it's something I didn't realize. So in iOS, when you open up an email or you open up certain screens, there's a print option.
Okay.
That when you hit print, it'll go to... it'll look for error printers, and it'll show you a preview of what you're about to print.
Okay.
So a little window, and then it looks for the error printer. Well, if you don't have an error printer, this window has always seemed really useless to me, because there's no print to PDF option. There's nothing that it seems like I would want to do here, so I usually just cancel right out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then this week, as I was reading something, someone pointed out, no, on that screen, if you pinch... on the image, so you go to email and choose print, and then there's a little picture of the email. Mm-hmm. If you pinch on that image and pull out, it actually expands to a new window that has a full iOS share sheet on it. So this is now if you do have an email that you want to save as a PDF and then upload to a document library,
right,
or whatever you might be doing with it, you can do that without having to have a third-party app. So I thought that was a pretty cool feature, that nowhere in the interface does it look like you can do it, but you totally can.
And it's totally non-intuitive.
No, and it, like I said, the interface doesn't make it look like you can do anything with that little picture of your thing. It just looks like it's a preview of what you're going to print out. But if you take two fingers, press down, and pull apart, it will launch into a new window that has a full share menu, so you can send that PDF or whatever document it is wherever you want it to go. I think it actually always goes to PDF, because that's how the AirPrint is expecting the input or something along those lines.
So, you know, that's a pretty useful... Actually, it's a probably not frequently used feature, but when you need it, it sounds pretty useful.
I'm thinking about documentation-wise, where when you just want to send or save an email chain in something other than EML format or PST format.
But, you know, it and I have a little mini rant here. Whatever happened to the intuitive iOS interface? Remember when iOS first came out? I mean, everybody, remember how amazed we were by pinch to zoom and all that kind of stuff? And we said, yeah, that makes sense, right? It all made sense. I mean, sure, you had to be shown it once, but once you saw it, it was like, yeah, that makes so much sense. And then they, you know, started hiding menus, and we got the menuless, or what I call the clueless interface, where there's no clue on how to actually do anything in your phone unless you already know how to do it, or somebody shows it to you. And now we have these things like this. I don't even know how to describe it. Use two fingers. Okay, I'm reading your instructions here. Use two fingers to pan out the image of the document. You'll get another menu, because that makes so much sense.
Well, and it actually just blows up the picture. So I'll actually, this is going to be totally worthless for our listeners, but I will show you what this looks like. So you can tell me if you agree. So I'm on an email here, just a regular email.
Right.
And then I go to the bottom where it's got the little what options
do you want to do.
And the one I'm going to choose is print.
Okay.
So then it shows me this screen, which has like a selection for printers at the top, which I don't have any printer, it'll work.
Right.
And then it has what looks like it's just a picture of what you're going to print.
Right, a thumbnail.
But if you take your two fingers and pull it, see if I can do this while you're on, I'll do it.
Whatever the opposite of pinch is, unpinch.
Pull it out.
Yeah.
You get a full screen, and at the top, you have a full share menu.
Right.
That will let you do whatever you want to do with it, send it wherever you want it to go.
Sigh.
Yeah, so it is a very, very strange sort of interface.
Which is unfortunately becoming typical for all UI designers, whether they're Microsoft or Google or Apple, this clueless interface, which is driving me nuts.
Yeah, who would have thought that going to a screen that's titled Printer Options would let you pull out and then get
another printer
exactly
option.
What you want. Yeah. Well, actually, go back even a step further and go to save options, really.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah. Okay. And so yours is pretty useful, actually, even though it's non-intuitive. Mine is non-intuitive also. It's a Windows 10 tip that I heard on Windows Weekly a couple of podcasts ago. And I have not yet tried it yet because, you know, I don't ever use Windows 10 at home anymore. I mean, I have Windows 10 boxes. I'm just too lazy to wait for it to boot up. If you press the Windows key plus a period, or Windows, or not Windows key and then a plus sign, Windows key and the period sign, or Windows key and the semicolon key, it brings up an emoji picker. Now, I don't know why I thought this was so cool when I heard it on Windows Weekly, but I still think it's kind of cool. It's just that because I don't use Windows at home, I've never tried. I have Windows in the office. That's all I use in the office, but I didn't have any need to use it. But if you are an emoji sender in, using whatever app you have in Windows 10, there you go. Windows key and a period button and a period key, or Windows key and a semicolon, brings up an emoji picker. And so you can now send emoji email or whatever it is you do with emojis. John, I can see John in the video, and he looks extremely excited by this.
I mean, I don't think... So, here's the annoyance I have with Windows 10.
Okay.
So, I'm going to send emojis in what? In email? I mean, most people, when they're sending emojis, they do it through chat.
Yeah.
I don't have any of the chat clients I use regularly that work on Windows 10. iMessage doesn't work on Windows 10. I've got... You know, I guess Google Voice, I could go over there and use the web interface for that. But I do probably 90% of my texting through iMessage.
Well, you know, John, if your students learn this, they might submitting to you term papers written all in emojis now because it's easier.
That wouldn't be too surprising. I mean, I occasionally do get emojis in texts and emails. So it would not be too surprising to get a whole term paper written in emoji. And I could probably just send, like, the angry face emoji back or the sad face emoji. Seems like that would be sufficient.
You know who this would really help out? And I've never seen it myself, but I've heard about it. Is somebody, some person, translated one of Shakespeare's works in emoji, like a sonnet or something. I have not seen it, but now I'm curious.
That sounds very interesting, but I do not think I would get the same enjoyment out of it as reading a Shakespearean song.
I should mention that in addition to his other skills, John is also a novelist. And I'm thinking, you might want to write a novel in emoji. Maybe not a novel, maybe a short story. Novel might be pushing it.
I could maybe do a short story in emoji. It would be a very interesting challenge. But there are very interesting challenge books out there. One of my favorites is called Euanoia by Christian Bach. The whole idea is every chapter, it's basically avant-garde poetry in a sense, but every chapter only uses one vowel exclusively.
Ouch.
So you have a chapter of A's, a chapter of E's, a chapter... And it leads to some very interesting verses because... You have to work around the limitation of only using that one vowel.
Only one vowel? No other vowels? Any consonant, but one vowel.
Yeah, any consonant, but only one vowel.
Wow. That is a challenge.
So, let me see if I can find an example of it.
All right. And while John does that, I'll start talking about the next topic, which is... My newest purchase, so I, you know, folks who've, our Fives as listeners who've been listening to this for years, know that for the past 2.5 years, I've been pretty much using a Chromebook, a Samsung Chromebook Plus specifically, pretty heavily in my home. I mean, you know, it's either that or an iPad. And generally, if I'm just sitting around, literally sitting, it's the Samsung Chromebook Plus. Did you find it, John? I'll keep talking.
I'm on the Wikipedia page, so keep talking. Next break.
So it's over 2.5 years old. And I thought, erroneously, that it was either getting close to or at the point where it would not get automatic updates, Chrome OS updates. It turns out I'm wrong, by the way. And I was kind of surprised, but I'll do a little look up now, but Well, the Samsung Chromebook Plus, which is now, well, like I said, mine is 2.5 years old, but it actually came out a little earlier than that, so, you know, maybe 2.75 years old. But the Chromebook Plus from Samsung, and I don't know why this doesn't open automatically. Actually, end of life from OS update point of view, fairly late in the game. And Chromebook Plus, August 2023. So it's still got another 4 years of updates left to it. So I'm pretty happy by that. It means basically my Chromebook, my original Chromebook, is going to be useful for the foreseeable future. But I've enjoyed it so much, and I've been wanting to do some other things like run Crostini, which is the Linux container option that's in beta, but available. You don't have to download anything and install anything. You just check off a box in Chrome OS and turn on Crostini. I thought, you know, I'd like a little bit of faster notebook with maybe more resources. So the Samsung Chromebook Plus, which I bought first, I think it has 4 gigs of RAM and 32 or 64 gigabytes of solid state drive. And I also bought a 64 gigabyte mini SD card for it too, for external storage. You know, for if I'm storing music or something like that. I mean, why would you do that when you have Google Play? But still, you know, you might want to do it. So I put it in there. Any rate, and it runs a custom version of ARM. And by custom, I mean Samsung and Google work together to optimize the processor in the Chromebook Plus for Google OS. And so it's pretty sprightly. It runs pretty well. But like I said, I wasn't sure if Crostini was going to, you know, really tax it, right? Because it's already emulating Android or doing something with Android, runs Chrome OS, and now you're going to put Linux containers on the system. Mm-hmm. So I said, that might be pushing that processor. So I held off on trying it. And I bought an Acer Spin, let's see, what is it called? Acer Spin 13. Now, there's a whole bunch of Acer Spin 13, and this one, end of life's June 2024, so I've got 5 years left on it before, which I think is fine. I think that's a perfectly reasonable expectation. It's a little bit bigger, so the Chromebook Plus is, I think, about an 11.5-inch screen. The Spin is 13, as the name would imply. But more importantly, it comes with a quad-core i5, 8th-generation i5, so it's a lot faster processor, 8 gigs of RAM, and I think the version I got has 128 gigs of solid-state drive. You can also get a bumped-up version that has a quad-core i7 and things, but basically it was a sweet spot for me. It was on sale at Amazon on Amazon Prime Day for $600. I had enough points, so I paid 58 cents. So it was a relatively painless purchase. I mean, it did take a while to save up all those points, but that's what I saved it for, you know, the kind of a big ticket item. Really happy with it so far. Can't say I know a whole heck of a lot about it yet, because I've just been using it as a daily machine. I turned on Crostini, it installed, you know, some container to do stuff. Haven't really played with it much. I was really impressed to see that Crostini comes with Python and Perl and all the usual, you know, Linux tools you would expect to use, development tools you expect to use, built in. I sort of doubt if it has windowing, you know, X-Windows, X11. But if it does, that'd be kind of fun to play with.
I'm looking at Acer's website on it right now. Mm-hmm. And apparently it looks optimized to be used to design clothing if you have multiple tattoos. Because that's the marketing message I'm getting here, is that if you are a very inked fashion designer with short hair, you probably could use this thing in your daily work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of that. But,
yeah.
So I don't know how you're going to do doing doodles on it, unless you plan on printing those out and having your own line of clothing that
doodle,
has your doodles
doodle
on
clothing,
it.
Doodle shirts.
In which case, you're probably good.
So, yeah, it is, you know, like a lot of things these days, John, and although you're quite a bit younger than me, we are not the target market for these things, at least from a marketing point of view.
I am shocked. I'm so totally shocked.
Yeah, we are not
well,
the market.
It's interesting. I was at a presentation
on Generations, and it was talking about how the millennial generation is so much more collaborative. And that's all the marketing you see today pushes you toward collaboration and things like that. Whereas Gen Xers like myself, we don't like to collaborate. We want us what we want, what you need done, and we'll get it done and get it to you and leave us alone. So that's I can definitely tell that there's not marketing for me anymore when I see something that really amps up the collaborative aspect of that.
You know, John, I hate to tell you this, but you cannot be a hipster. I mean, you have the beard for it. Okay, I'll grant you that. You got the beard, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I know. But I can become a curmudgeonly old man, and so that might be my next career goal.
Well, you know, you've got a few years to go before you hit that mark, but you got to start working on it. You know, you'll be good at it by the time you get there.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely.
And speaking of hipsters and, you know, the artiste types, one of the things it does come with is what do you call those things? QHD? It's kind of a 2K screen versus, you know, the 10. So it's above 1080p, which is 920 by 1080. QHD is 2256 by 1504, but it's not 4K. It's kind of halfway in between. And I have to say the screen is quite nice. And having a slightly larger screen. Oh, also, it is, I think, a 3x2 screen. So, you know, I hate 16x9. Oh, I prefer 3x2 screens. I don't hate 16x9 screens, but I prefer a 3x2. You know, basically a taller screen. So I'm really happy with that. And like the Samsung Chromebook Plus, it comes with a, I think it's called it's a Wacom technology. It's a Wacom EMR. And I can't remember what EMR stands for, but basically it's a battery-less stylus technology. And somehow it seems to do some pressure sensitivity and things like that. You know, I guess in working with the screen itself. So it's not quite as good as using an Apple Pencil with an iPad. But it's a lot better than using your standard, you know, $5 capacitive stylus, the rubber tip capacitive stylus on a capacitive screen. And I actually did try doodling with it, you know, my little drawings that I do. So it's not bad. The palm rejection has some issues, I thought. The software itself has some issues, but that's a whole other story. But as far as a doodling tool, it's actually pretty good. And you don't have to pay an extra $100 or $130. It is built right into the device, into the Chromebook, and you just slide it out from the case, and you slide it back into the case for transport, and it's quite handy.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good.
Yep. Okay, so next up on our list of stuff is... how come I pasted that in?
You're reading what I pasted in.
Oh, okay.
That is the excerpt from the book Eunoia from Chapter O.
Oh, loops on bold fonts now form lots of words for books. Wow, that is... And it goes on and on. Profs from Oxford show Froshidu postdocs. Froshidu postdocs? How to gloss works of wordsmith. Since when does a freshman do a postdoc? But okay.
I don't know.
Unless they're talking, over there they refer to a first year postdocs as freshmen. I don't know. It's possible.
I don't know.
Okay, that sounds very painful.
Another line from that wonderful chapter is, folks from Kokomo do lots of shrooms. Not snow, not blow, no form of hops. Yeah. I like that. Folks from Kokomo do lots of shrooms.
Sounds like a Beach Boys song.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Next up actually is a pretty interesting and long, I should say, long article in CNET. You know, we don't often quote CNET anymore. It used to be the thing we read the first thing in the morning, or at least for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I call this The Sad History of Southern Pacific Railroad Internal Networking Telephony, a.k.a. Sprint, which will cease to exist after it completes its merger with T-Mobile, which was just approved Friday? Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
finally a merger happened for those two. You know, T-Mobile's been trying to merge with people for years. Yeah. Sprint's been trying to merge, and finally they get together with each other.
Yeah.
It is sort of sad. Sprint was always sort of the one that you hoped would maybe be able to pull it off and just never could.
Right.
I remember back in 2011 or so,
right before the SoftBank. I guess I'm always grateful to Sprint because I did get one of the largest stock gains ever in my investing career off Sprint. Because at some point they were selling for $2 a share, and I picked them up, and then I sold them at like $7 a share. So I was quite happy with that.
Yeah.
But I always hoped that Sprint would, because Sprint, you know, was probably one of the lesser evil phone companies out there. I definitely, you know, Verizon and AT&T have the market cornered for evilness.
Yeah.
Sprint and T-Mobile had a little bit better of a rapport, I thought, with customers. But
yeah,
I'll be sad to see Sprint go.
I was a Sprint customer for many years. I'm thinking, when did I stop using Sprint? Boy, it was a long time ago, but despite it being a long time ago, I was a Sprint customer probably for 10 plus years at one point. And in fact, I think my daughter, I know what happened. I gave my daughter my number because I gave her my phone. And then, you know, we started getting her own phones. But yeah, I guess we had it until a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago. I haven't used it in many years. But the problem with Sprint was where she was going to college, the coverage was just horrible. So after her first semester, I think it might have been after her first semester, we switched her to AT&T, which had pretty good coverage at her in and around her campus when she was out of Wi-Fi range. So when she was in Wi-Fi range, it didn't matter, of course. But yeah, so a really interesting story about the now late Sprint or soon to be late Sprint. And also, I'm not going to really talk much about it, but Dish Network, Dish TV, whatever they're called, they're buying some of the assets, the kind of the MVNO kind of stuff, the Boost Mobile and those kind of, I guess not MVNO, but the prepaid subsidiaries of Sprint. So apparently Dish Network is going to become the fourth cellular company or fourth mobile telephone company in the U.S. And it'll be interesting, to say the least.
It is, especially since Dish, their primary competitor, DirecTV, is a part of AT&T. Mm-hmm. So you just continue to see these things kind of shoot around to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Comcast tried to buy T-Mobile and Sprint or its assets also. So this might not be it's a done deal, but there might
They've been some. Trying. Everyone's been trying to buy everyone else in that space for so long. We'll see.
Yeah. And speaking of AT&T, so, AT&T bought Time Warner. Not Time Warner Cable, which is, a whole other animal that was purchased by Charter and is now called Spectrum. But AT&T bought the Time Warner Media company, which includes HBO. And they have a streaming service now called HBO Max, which I didn't know about until I read this article. But in addition to having it as a fragmented part of the streaming market, they are now going to introduce something called another video streaming service called AT&T TV. They have a lot of content now after purchasing Time Warner. So what does it include? I think it includes DC Comics. So, DC movies have not been as popular as the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, but they're direct to what used to be called direct to disc, and I guess now it's almost direct to streaming. DC Comics direct to streaming or direct to disc animated videos have been really well done and really popular. I've been getting them through DC Universe, which is also owned by AT&T, so I guess they have that too. And I'm not really sure what's going to happen now. Is it going to be killed? Which is sad because DC Universe is, which I talk about with Jay Stone on Comics News Podcast every now and then. DC Universe is a really great service. It's about $6 a month, I think. In addition to the video content, both old and new, they have original content on there. It includes DC's considerable backlog of comic books in digital format, which is quite good. The app itself is terrible compared to Comixology, but it's still usable. Although some days less usable than others when it crashes, but I don't know, John. How many streaming services do you subscribe to? I subscribe to like maybe half a dozen now, I think.
Yeah, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime through Prime membership.
Right, right.
YouTube Plus.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot about that.
I just don't want to watch ads.
Yeah.
And what else am I subscribing to? I don't really think I have any other streaming video services. I do have an Apple Music subscription for music, so.
Hmm.
It's getting crazier and crazier, all of the ways to get content.
Yeah. I'm just kind of thinking mine through. Let's see, Netflix, Amazon Prime, like you, and you called the YouTube Plus. I actually, and it's the same service, but I went through Google Play Music, which, you know, either one gets you all the same services, just a different way of entering the system. CBS All Access for Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out there's a lot of other stuff on there that I enjoy watching, so I'm glad I did that. And DC Universe, and Viki.com, which has basically world video. Maybe a little U.S. too, but mostly from Asia and Europe and stuff. So if you enjoy that sort of stuff, that's where to go. Especially since AT&T killed Drama Fever, which was the competing service until last year. And it was really good. I really preferred it to Viki. But it's gone now because AT&T killed it. And I wonder if they're going to kill DC Universe next. All right. Let's see. So two more items on our list and we're done. So next one is something I really haven't tried yet. I just read about it earlier this morning, called Google Gallery Go for Android. And basically it is what they call a lightweight photo viewing and editing app. And I just installed it in mine. And by lightweight, they mean it's 10 megabytes in size. And ironically, John, you know, when the IBM XT first came out, it had a 10 megabyte hard drive. So this one app would fill up that entire hard drive. Actually, more than that, because you needed some for DOS. And back then, we thought 10 megabytes of storage. What are we going to do with all of that storage? And how are we going to use it? Now we know. One app, you're done.
Yeah.
But in any case, it's supposed to be really lightweight, really fast. I'm looking at, basically, it's only got two tabs that I can see so far on the bottom. One says photos, another says folders. And if you tap on folders, it kind of divides it up into screenshots and photos taken on, you know, locally on this one. Photos I put on Instagram. Photos from messages, which I didn't know. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of useful. It's only 10 megabytes. I think I'll leave it on the system. It even has a folder for Office Lens. You know, screen like whiteboard shots that I used Office Lens for. So it's even got that. It's got one called Pictures, but it's all whiteboards. I'm not sure what that's all about. And it's supposed to do some editing, although I don't really... Well, let me open up a photo. Oh, yeah, there is an edit button. So there's an edit button and all of that. So it looks... And it's very fast. So I'm going to start investigating it a bit more. It's free. It's from Google. And you can download it now. So there you go. You have your little rant.
Yeah, I have a very little rant, and it's about, actually, as you would call them, my super secret missions. Next weekend, I will be traveling, and it's not all that super secret. My in-laws are taking an upper Mississippi River boat cruise.
That sounds like fun.
And my wife and I decided, since they're flying into St. Louis to embark on their cruise, we thought, well, we'll drive up to St. Louis. It's about 6 hours from us, and we'll see them for a day or so before they head out. And so I have a hotel room for Friday or for Saturday night, but Friday night we thought, well, we'll go up early. And I thought, well, let's stay somewhere, you know, outside of downtown. We'll just kind of go in, maybe do some shopping and, you know, go to a hotel pool or something like that. And now St. Louis, I have nothing against St. Louis. I've been there a couple times, but St. Louis does have a bit of a reputation that there are some areas of St. Louis that you do not want to go to at certain times of day.
A little sketchy.
When it's dark out. Yeah, a little sketchy, a little dangerous at times. And so this got me thinking, you know, where do I stay? I don't know anyone in St. Louis, so it's not like I could call up someone and say, hey, where are the good neighborhoods?
Yeah.
So I went to the crime statistics for St. Louis County, and I was looking at, you know, what neighborhoods tend to have more crime reported and which ones don't. And I thought, why isn't this a layer in Apple Maps or Google Maps? Like, you know, it's a piece of information, and it's definitely much more useful to me than, you know, attractions or, you know, even restaurants or hotels. Like, knowing where it is, you know, more or less likely to be safe to be is sort of a good idea. I suspect Google would get in trouble and Apple would get in trouble for, you know, blacklisting certain neighborhoods as red neighborhoods or something like that.
Right,
but still,
right.
It seems like a useful piece of information that you would want overlaid on a map.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mention that, because I remember when Google Maps first came out, and, you know, it had the ability to allow third parties to, you know, individuals to come in and take Google Maps and overlay it with their own information, right? And I remember the first things that came out was a kind of a crime density map for Chicago or someplace around Chicago. And it created an uproar. Because, you know, the people felt like, oh, you're discriminating against certain neighborhoods or whatever the thing is. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. You know, it's you should know. You know, when people come visit in Honolulu, I tell them, well, you know, there are certain places you probably shouldn't go after it's dark.
Well, and there are also just certain places that, you know, crime aside, they're just a certain amount ago. So, you know, maps that might have not just crime data, but also, you know, population density activity, you know, commercial density versus residential, things like that. So you can go, well, gee, am I, you know, is my hotel going to be near a bunch of other things to do, or is my hotel kind of one-off, you know, by five different places on the, you know, an off-ramp to the highway or something like that. You don't really know those things unless you dig in and start viewing the street view and viewing the, you know, the map really extensively to see where you're going and what is likely to be there when you get there.
So I'm looking up from my area, and the Honolulu Police Department, HPD, has a, it's actually pretty interesting, has an interactive map of crimes, including type of crimes, by the way. And I think they include car accident as a, well, it's not a crime, but, you know, as an incident. Oh, no, it's a motor vehicle theft. Sorry, the little car icon is a motor vehicle theft. So you can see what kind of crimes appear, you know, took place and where. But, you know, it doesn't really tell you which is more dangerous. It, you know, basically, you see more crimes or it's more populated, but that's not always, you know, an indication of safety in, you know, unless, I guess, you filter it by, like, violent crimes or something like that. But anyway, so they are available. You're right. Yeah, I don't think... Of course, you could build one, maybe. You could, you know, build one into Google My Maps or something.
It just seems like a very strange sort of thing that's missing that could be more useful.
Sounds like a third-party thing. You know, it's like I built a map for my coworkers to find places to eat within a 10-minute walk of our office. So... And Google kind of has that, but it's missing a lot of the, you know, the little places that don't show up on Google Maps. But that is it. So I guess we're going to miss the podcast next week while John is on a super secret mission. And we'll regroup when he gets back. And we're coming up on podcast 299 and 300. So we should invite some of our old friends to join us on 300.
We will endeavor to have something interesting to talk about on them.
Yeah, we can only hope, right? Anyway, so that's podcast 298. It's in the can, and we will talk to you next time.